welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 5 days a week for your listening pleasure. And my very special guests today are Jerry and Kathy Wills. They are adventurers who seek out ancient places with a mysterious past. They document their travels throughout South America and put their videos up on their websites for others to enjoy. They have a lot of fun traveling and enjoying their life as they search for answers in strange and remote locations. So if you're not at home, if they're not at home in the US, you can be pretty sure that they'll be somewhere very off the beaten track, like deep in the Amazon, or at some remote mountaintop in the Andes, or at some ancient Rothschild sacrificial site. Jerry has also been a co-host of the Kevin Smith Show, but sadly Kevin passed on unexpectedly earlier this month, leaving Jerry and Kathy grieving his loss, along with many loyal Kevin Smith fans who are still mourning his untimely death. Now, I would like to now welcome them to the show. Jerry and Kathy, welcome.
Yes, hi, how are you doing? Thank you for having us on.
Yeah, well, quite well, actually, you know, considering.
Yeah, excellent.
Yeah. Well, could you tell us a little bit about Kevin Smith, considering you were the co-host for a short period of time there?
Yeah, I was the co-host for a few years, actually, off and on. It wasn't a full-time position. It was just as Kevin, whenever he would need some help, I would sit in for him. Kevin was really quite a brilliant fellow to go on talk radio, and I think because of his background as a police officer and a detective, he had, of course, an inquisitive mind and a manner in which he would, ask questions. It seemed to get right to the heart of the matter. And, I think that's the reason why folks liked it so well. He was kind of a no BS kind of guy.
Rather ironic for a police officer.
Yeah.
Now, on top of this, there is a long history that you is Kathy even there?
Yeah, she is. She's right off to the side here. She's listening in.
Okay, okay. So I'm just basically going to be interviewing you, Jerry, and Kathy's just kind of like off to the side, you know, just listening in. All right.
She'll be vocal anytime now. You can count on it. When she has something to say, she'll be right there.
All right. Now, I have down here this recent trip that you had to Bolivia, May of this year, to hunt down ancient footprints set in rock. But before we get into that, I wanted to know how you actually started doing what it is that you're doing now, because you've come into these very interesting and strange fields with basically information that bends reality itself to a large degree, according to mainstream science. I was wondering, what gave you the kick, the nudge, the oomph to go and do all this kind of stuff?
Well, in my earlier years, I was quite a fan of different authors that addressed the ancient places and the mysterious things that were around the world, and it caught my interest, of course, I think as it did many others. It wasn't until early 1990s, I was invited to be a guest host on a trip that was going to Peru, and I had been invited to go along. My trip was paid for, and I would be there to talk to the people and, you know, socialize with them during the trip. I had never been, so I had no idea what I was in for. But I was very interested in going to Peru. I'd read so much about it. Daniken, all of his books, I'd read them. Sitchin, I'd read, you know, whatever he had available at the time, and others, you know, and I was excited. So that's how it all really started, going to South America. That trip was a great success. And at the end of that trip, the fellow who was putting on the tour said that he was retiring. He was no longer doing trips. And if I wanted to, I could take over the trips. He would give me his mailing list, his contacts, and so forth. So I jumped at the opportunity and started putting on my own versions of this trip. Instead of it being 8 days or 9 days. I turned it into 2 weeks and took folks on a fantastic adventure 2 weeks at a time and maintained that for well over a decade. It was during that period of time that, you know, you make a lot of friends down there, and these friendships became more and more solidified. My curiosity, of course, I was asking them about places that I'd read about, and they would tell me about things that they knew, and some of these things were not really on the tourist track, so I asked to see them. They eventually took me to see things that most folks don't see, and eventually took a video camera and made a short clip of one of them called the Temple of Time and Space. Pukhar is the name of it, the very first video. And a lot of our friends and family really enjoyed that. So we put it up online, and a lot of folks online enjoyed it as well, asking us to make more. We should be on the Discovery Channel, someone would say. So I contacted Discovery. They said, well, if you make, you know, 6 or 7 clips, we'll take a look and let you know if we're interested. So we did. Invested more into good cameras and equipment. Tried to refine the techniques of actually producing a short documentary. And at the end of a couple of years of doing that, and these were being put online, of course, we even moved to Peru at one point. We contacted Discovery and Nat Geo and some others, and they very politely but bluntly said they weren't interested. If they were interested in something like that, they would have contacted us, basically go away. Well, we decided, between Kathy and I, that we would make our own TV station. Don't need that. We can do it ourselves, and we did, and we created ExpeditionsTV.com. Since then, it's evolved. It's been since 2006, so it's about 7 years now, and we've evolved to Expeditions.tv, and we put all of our materials online. Folks can watch freely, and you know, we continue to go down and to do more videotaping, to produce more shows, you know, not as frequently as we would like, of course, but it's a costly thing to do. So this mention of having gone to Bolivia, we were down there and we shot 2 more episodes while we were there. That's how we got started.
Now, the impossible footprints in the sands of time of Bolivia. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
Yeah, that was a really interesting thing. We were down there in 2008. One of our last groups, actually, because we've stopped taking groups down. But we were told while we were at on our way to Tiwanaku that there was a footprint that had been found, a human footprint, believed to be a couple of million years old, and that it was just recently discovered. So we asked our guide, who was an archaeological assistant, to find out more. He came back the next day and says, well, I'm told that it's on an island on the Bolivian side of Lake Titicaca, which would be the south end of Lake Titicaca, that the folks who own that island, the Aymara Indians, they're not very keen on having anyone go there. They're very protective of it. And if you went there, then they might let you see it, but there's no way to know for sure, and it's quite a journey to get to this island. Well, we pretty much couldn't do it. We were wanting to try, but it just was impractical given the nature of being on a tour with other folks. We never were told where the island was. So for the next, 4 years, 5 years, we were curious where it was, put out feelers, no one knows. Michael Cremo knew about it, but didn't know where it was at. So Kathy, because we were in Peru, we were shooting the Doomsday Stone and planning to shoot a continuance of Cumbe Mayo. So Kathy gets on what little bit of an internet there is and starts doing a search. And on a blog in Portugal, she discovers in Portuguese a reference point to where the footprint could be found. And of course, she translated it in Google and came up with the name. So she looked on a map and pinpointed exactly where it was. It wasn't an island after all. It was in the middle of northern Bolivia on the Altiplano. So at the end of doing some more shooting for Cumbamayo, we hopped a jet and flew to southernmost Peru and then went by land, overland, out to the Altiplano, northern Bolivia, following, you know, the trail, as it were, using a satellite map and a GPS to help guide us along some roads that were almost non-existent. And we eventually found the village and climbed the mountain, and there it was. Except it wasn't there, actually. When we got to the location on top of the mountain, someone had taken a rock saw and cut it out of the rock strata that it was found in. It was just gone. The people in the village, the Aymara, they said, yeah, well, there were some guys that showed up in a couple of trucks. They went up for about 6 hours. They came back down. They drove off, and our footprint was gone. This footprint to them was evidence of their ancestral connection, a very sacred thing. They didn't know who it was or why it was that had been taken. Well, we found out later that an archaeological team from La Paz had come in and cut it out and taken it into La Paz, put it on display for a couple of weeks, and after that, no one has any record of what happened to it. It just vanishes. Well, while we were up at the top of the mountain, Kathy decided that even though it wasn't there, she theorized, actually, that, well, if someone was here and it was a footprint, they had to have walked about, so there should be other footprints. Well, you'd have to see the location. It sounded absurd to me, but if she wanted to go looking, then why not? Well, within about 45 minutes, because she was looking specifically for it, I presume, she located two more footprints. One is so indiscernible, it really doesn't qualify as a footprint. It's just an odd-looking depression. But the other one is actually quite clear. And once we determined that that was actually a footprint, as best as we could, we geolocated it and started videotaping and documenting the site.
And in terms of the implications, what does a footprint in this particular location actually mean? I mean, how old is it?
Well, you know, as best as we can tell, because we're not really archaeologists or geologists, but there have been archaeological teams and geological teams there. They've dated this rock to be somewhere, and of course, I don't know how they figure this out, but they say it's somewhere between 7 and 15 million years old. And then others say 5 and 15 million years old. So there's a little bit of uncertainty as far as the age. It's rock, so I mean, how old could it be? I suppose it could be quite old. The original footprint, Bolivian archaeologists gave it a date of 5 million years old, and others have given it a date of 1.5 million to 2 million years old. This is in a similar strata of rock, so far as we know. It'll take more educated folks than ourselves to make that determination. It might actually be older than that. We don't know. But I think it's safe to say that it's well over 1 million years old and could quite possibly be quite a bit older than 1 million years old. But, you know, even if it's only 1 million years old, that really smacks in the face of accepted archaeological thinking that the bipedal humans who were upright and walking and thinking were more like 300,000 years ago and not 1 million, let alone many millions of years ago. It isn't accepted.
What's your impression of ancient cultures? Were they? There's some people going around saying that they were as advanced as we are today. And I think your speakers are a bit high there. Please turn them down. There's a bit of feedback. You listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. We're broadcasting live 5 days a week. That's Tuesday through Saturday in New Zealand and Monday through Friday in the USA and the Uber Kingdom and various other places around the globe. And you can find the archives at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. That's the only place you will find the archives of the Vinnie Eastwood Show at the moment. And if you donate financially or contribute something, you know, or whatever, we've got commercial free archives for you as well. Saves about, I'd say about half an hour of listening time per show. Adds up to about 10 hours of saved time per month or whatever. So, you know, you can do that for like $5 a month. If you like, or, you know, dollar a month, whatever. Just do something to support this broadcast, if you can, to show that you appreciate it and all the amazing, fabulous guests who have incredible stories to tell that we have on. And they donate their time freely as well. And I'm very appreciative to that, particularly of my very special guests who are notoriously difficult to get a hold of because of their career restraints, the late nights, and the huge quantity of work that they actually have to put out kind of like on a daily basis. Jerry and Kathy Wills. Now, I also wanted to, we were talking over the break about how, you know, you kind of keep late nights and you're doing an awful lot of work. And I'm just wondering, what's a typical day like for you?
Well, a typical day is really very crazy. Well, we usually get started somewhere around 9 o'clock in the morning. And, of course, we have Expeditions TV that we contend with to keep everything updated as best we can. We answer emails and take care of business until about 2 or 3 in the afternoon. By usually 1 o'clock, we will have a bite to eat. That's our breakfast time, really. We keep working until around 6:30 or 7 on whatever the business is that's at hand, whether it's editing, preparing for a broadcast. I mean, there's so many different things. And then after that, we have something to eat, and if need be, we go back to whatever it is we were doing, and we continue working until 10 to midnight, and then we'll stop and be too tired to carry on, so we'll go to bed. That's how it is at home. When we're on the road, it basically is just nonstop, go, 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 go. And so we're always just on the move, it seems, you know, just it's exhausting at times.
Mm. And what was your, did you have a previous career prior to all of this?
Well, you know, my previous career prior to this, I operated an electronics company for about 30 years, and it was a much easier job, I think. And, you know, it's I'm not complaining that we have so much and we're on the go so much. It's just how it is. You know, we do enjoy what we do.
Mm. Well, in terms of this, can I ask you, what is your general impression of humans' past? I mean, you're not an archaeologist, you're not a geologist or whatever, but you have been to really a lot of amazing sites, seen some incredible things, and they must have left an impression on you about what early, way prehistoric man or even simply ancient civilizations must have been like. Are there any examples or stories that you might be able to share?
Well, there are a lot of examples. Anyone familiar with Michael Cremo's work And there are also a host of others out there who have spent a lot of time researching these things. There's enough evidence to support that something extraordinary happened in the distant past that caused civilization at whatever peak it had existed at that time to come to a crashing fall. And as far as what we've found and what we're looking for, the things that we've found support that. You see things that just can't possibly exist, but they do. And when you understand the dynamics of this, for example, rock that is cut with extraordinary precision, it's tens of thousands of years old. It was that old, you know, it was done that long ago with a polish that can't be achieved today. There's just so much evidence to support this. And the history that we've been led to believe is not the true history that occurred. And I don't know why it seems to have been directed in such a way that it would make it seem as though something entirely different happened in the past on this planet.
Has learning these things sort of opened your mind and changed the way you think about things?
Well, I think I always had an open mind, and I've always had an inquisitive attitude. It has reinforced my inquisitiveness, and it's reinforced my desire to keep looking. There's a lot of information. I mean, we just came across information this last trip that was mind-blowing, things we didn't even expect to find, and yet there it is. It was fantastic.
Well, like what?
Well, you know, I don't have exact dates memorized because it's all so new, but I can give you a thumbnail sketch. One example is this. Because we were looking for information, a little snippet of information came to us about a possible, they called it a castle, up in the highlands in the Andes in Bolivia. So we started doing some research, Kathy did, and it suddenly became clear that there were things that just didn't match up. For example, there's a place in Paraguay called the Viking Stronghold. Why would they call it that? Well, they call it that because there are symbols there, the language from the Vikings. We've discovered that there's... there's a village up in the Andes where they still worship Odin and speak a dialect from the Vikings' time. Well, what we discovered, by and large, putting little pieces of information together that seem to fit, that there's a map that we have assembled figuratively that takes us from the east coast of Brazil all the way across the South American continent into the Andes and to where the supposed castle is supposed to be, and plus a few other places. And along this line, there are sites like the Viking Stronghold. So consequently, we now see that the Vikings were involved in being in South America somehow. But it didn't finish there, because then we started wondering, well, who were these people who could do such extraordinary stonework, and why is it that it seems to have such a resemblance to what's in the Middle East? Well, with a little bit of extrapolation and a few more snippets of details, we started putting together that the people that were coming over here from the Middle East were the Phoenicians. And with the Phoenicians, there were refugees from some of the wars that were taking place. They came along with the Phoenicians because they wanted to go someplace else, offering their goods and services, their talents, in exchange for passage. Well, the Phoenicians were fantastic traders, and they were visiting South America for quite some time. They had set up trade routes. We'd already discovered this and know it to be an absolute. The absolute details we don't know, but the absoluteness that it occurred is in place. And now we suspect that the people who were building places, the fantastic places like Tiwanaku, Pumapunku, Machu Picchu, and a whole host of other places that string from Chile through Bolivia, through Peru, all the way, Ecuador and Colombia, that these people were the ancestors of those folks who came across with the Phoenicians and built these great cities. And truth is, when they talk about the Chechapoya, they're the ones that say were responsible for these cities. Well, the Chechapoya were tall, fair-skinned, red to blonde hair, blue and green eyes, and were quite tall. Not at all like anybody in South America. So, we've gotten these little snippets and started putting them together, and it's becoming quite a story. The thing that we've been trying to reconcile is what happened. What is it that occurred that took civilization and set it right back down to the first peg? And we really don't know. We have theories, but one theory is as good as another. We haven't found any absolute detail that tells us what happened. The only clear idea that we have is that something occurred that made the earth stop for 3 days. And when that occurred, the oceans went, lifting over the Andes and washing away people and things, leaving sandbars at 13 and 14 and 15,000 feet, like in the Atacama, where you have a sperm whale just up there at 13,500 feet, just buried in the sand with dolphins and fish and other things. So apparently,
according to archaeologist Jonathan Gray, that there's hundreds of thousands of mountain ranges around the world that have all sorts of remains on them that don't belong there, human remains, tools, sea creatures, land creatures, plants, etc., where there's nothing there now.
Yes, well, and I've been in touch with Jonathan. I think he's an extraordinary researcher. I really respect his work. Mm. And, there are these sites. Something definitely occurred. And there's evidence worldwide for this.
Mm. And this is what a lot of people have termed as the global catastrophe. And many ancient cultures record a great flood. I believe 187 older cultures record a great flood, not just the Bible.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, even in the Andes, you have the mythology of the great flood and how the shepherd boy was told by the star people that he had to go to the top of the mountain, go in a cave and seal it with his animals because there was going to be a terrible event that happened. The world was going to be flooded. And when it was over, he'd be able to come back out. When he came out, he was looking from the top of a mountain as though he were standing just slightly above the ocean before it receded. So there's a lot of stories like this everywhere.
Well, ergo, I mean, if there's that many stories, and they all tell virtually the exact same thing, surely it's not a theory anymore. That must have been what happened.
Well, that's what we think as well. But the classical archaeological attitude is that it's just mythology; it didn't happen, and let's go on to the next thing.
Mm. Which is ironic, really, because archaeology is about finding real artifacts and things of that nature, and many things have been found which support this. My question is, why would mainstream science and archaeology try and keep this thing locked down as a myth? What are they protecting?
Yeah, that's a good question, isn't it? And I've wondered about that for a very long time. Why is it so important to keep the information away from the average person? what's back there in time that someone obviously doesn't want anyone else to know. And I just haven't got a clue. I mean, maybe it's something to do with where we are now and where we're headed, or perhaps something to do with how we as a people came to be in the first place. I don't know. I mean, it's in the same genre of questionability as UFOs, really.
There's this thing called normalcy bias, which I'm sure you encounter all the time. It can't exist because it doesn't sound normal.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really strange because, I don't know, I've been alive for 28 years, and most of the things that I've seen that appear strange turn out to be true, and most of the things that I thought were true turn out to be fabrications, lies, misinterpretations. And yet, society hasn't learned that same lesson that I've learned for some reason. Maybe it's because they haven't heard about things like what you're doing. Maybe it's because when you discover ancient mythology to be true, you wonder, I wonder what other myths are true, and I wonder what truths are really myths, and I wonder who would benefit from a society of people who don't question really anything of great importance. And we're coming on to break now, and we'll discuss this more after that one. Back in just a minute, ladies and gentlemen, with Jerry and Kathy Wells. Don't you go anywhere.
Unity, please don't desert me.
The word is about, there's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the show that's a little bit about history repeating. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humor, you'll go freaking nuts. And we have about a little over an hour left to go in the broadcast, about an hour and a quarter with Jerry and Kathy Wills. And we were talking over the break about what the purpose might be behind the normalcy bias and concealing this kind of information from the public. I made the point that I believe that there are powerful people who have a lot of influence, who are deeply into the occult and are obsessed with control, who don't want this information necessarily getting out and becoming mainstream and being believed and known about by everybody. I mean, if a few people know about it, so what? Who cares? What can a few people do, right? That's a big mistake there. And the other element is, and I think, Jerry, you made this point, if humanity knew who we really were, what we really come from, then all sorts of faith in many forms of institutionalized religion, institutionalized thinking, and so on and so forth, all of these mechanisms of psychological control would be greatly damaged by this kind of knowledge becoming widespread. And Jerry, I want to know how you came to that conclusion.
Well, I think it's a matter of really examining a few things that have happened. I mean, there are people who actually have found things that were fantastic and substantial. There's one place called Vallisquejo in Mexico where a gal, an archaeologist, she was, you know, at the time, very brilliant, had high marks in her college, one of the top of her class. They found a mastodon bone in a site in Vallisquejo, Mexico, that had etchings on it, and they also found some spear points and some other small items that hunters might have used, or would have used, really. She studied the layers which are laid down in a geological, you know, timeline. She studied the bone. She studied all of this, and she came up with a figure that said this has got to be, and I don't remember the exact dating she gave it, but let's say she said this has got to be about 80,000 years old. Well, that's impossible, because at the time she made the statement, which was back, I think, in the 60s or 70s, the accepted age that it could possibly be, where there's etchings on bone, was somewhere in the neighborhood of about 15,000 years, 15,000 to 20,000 years in that region. Well, she pressed onward and said, well, look, here's this pollen, here's all this other stuff. And she dated all these things and came up with, yeah, it looks like it's about 80,000 years old. She was ridiculed, harassed. She lost her funding. Archaeologists work on funding from universities unless they happen to get lucky and have a sponsor, some philanthropist, which she didn't have. She was ridiculed to the point to where she quit archaeology, and she went to work in a different business arranging flowers. Because she was ridiculed so terribly, there wasn't really much work that she could get. Meanwhile, the site of Vallisqueo was closed down. Once it was closed down, it was done so by the Mexican government. No one wanted to touch it for quite a while. Within the past decade, a friend of ours has gone back in and started studying the details. He made a video presentation about this. It's called Vallisqueo. It's probably up online somewhere. And it's being now determined using helium isotope emission, which gives you a much better dating on things than doing the carbon-14 test, that this site is for sure 800,000 years old, maybe over a million years old. So she's proven, she's been proven that she was off by several hundred thousand years, but for sure she was well within the scope of what she knew at the time. To say that it was about 80,000 years old is actually 10 times older than that. So, you know, there's some movement afoot to keep people in line, keep them in step. Don't go against the party lines. This is the accepted truth, and we don't want to have the actual truth. We run into that, and it's unfortunate. And that's why we go and videotape things and make these programs, and we put it out there so a person can make their own decision. Here's what we found. What do you think?
Now, there's a number of things that come to mind there. Myself, for example, I'm kind of like a fly-by-the-seat-of-my-pants kind of guy. You know, if I say something and I'm wrong, I'll admit it and just go, look, I'm sorry, and then find out whatever the truth is. Others, on the other hand, are very meticulous, and they don't say anything unless they know it for a fact to be true. And if they don't know it for a fact, they make sure to qualify by saying, this is just a thought or this is just a theory. And they go over very, very thoroughly over things before they say and do and or release them. I presume this is what your methodology is.
Well, we try to be accurate. We try to present things in an unbiased way. But sometimes you find things that just smack you in the face as being, hey, you know, this is crazy. This is so old that what does it mean? So, yeah, we do try to be accurate, though. You're right. And we try to give the truth as best we know it.
And, of course, the difficulty is with your field, people won't believe the truth even if you tell it to them. In a lot of cases, will they?
Well, by and large, no. you know, there, of course, are those folks out there who are curious and willing to listen. I mean, let's face it, von Daniken sold a lot of books to people who were just like you and I, who are wanting to find out more. And if it's true, well, then that's really something. If it isn't, well, at least it was interesting to read about, and it got me to thinking. By and large, people would really like to know more. But the problem is that, you know, when you start hitting mainstream, there are two camps. There are the people... Actually, three. They're the people who really don't give a care one way or the other. Then there's the one on the other side that says, well, unless you have some degrees, you can't make a valid statement about anything.
Mm.
Then there's a larger camp in the middle, I think, who says, you know, I'd like to know more. What can you tell me? And I'll figure it out for myself from there. And those are the folks that we, I suppose, appeal to. But that camp doesn't seem to have the power to change public opinion because they're just like you and I. They're curiosity seekers, folks who just want to know more, and that's about it.
And not members of the Council on Foreign Relations.
Yes, exactly.
And the Trilateral Commission, and the Bilderberg Group, and so on and so forth. Because, you know, it seems like, I don't know about you, but when the word mainstream comes to mind, I think of somebody just taking a leak on the truth. Really.
Well, I do that's too.
That's the stream that I see.
Yeah, well, that is the mainstream, and you're right. You know, I've avoided the controversial to a point. I didn't want to point my fingers and say it's because of these people or those people. And it's mostly because I don't have adequate proof to support such a claim. But, you know, when it comes right down to finding things that have no other explanation except that this happened. You know, like, for example, those whale bones and dolphin bones on the Atacama Desert up, you know, 13, 14,000 feet. Well, how did that get there? You know, it's mind-boggling. And why would someone, anyone, not want to say, yeah, you know, this happened and here's the details? But we run into it with all of these fringe things that we work with. The story about the city in the Grand Canyon. We were just with Scott Walter up there shooting a segment for America Unearthed, I think it is. And yeah, everybody thought, oh, it's just ridiculous. There's no city in the Grand Canyon. There was a story, and then it was proven to be a joke. Well, it wasn't proven to be a joke. We actually, Kathy, proved it to be factual by finding something that everyone else had missed and pointing to it and saying, look, you know, this isn't a joke. This is real.
That seems to be happening quite a lot. I mean, even I think I was at a protest a couple of weeks ago, and a guy was talking about how there's no cure for cancer, there's no cure for cancer. And I say, well, that's not strictly true. There's many cures for cancers. He goes, oh, yeah, but they've all been debunked. And they go, well, what do you mean? They've all been debunked. And the fact of the matter is he had no idea what he was talking about. Had no clue as to what I was going to say next, yet assumed that he did and had no evidence to prove his own claim and was simply attempting a despotic sense of ridicule so that other people wouldn't listen to me. And you think to yourself, you know, this is at a protest. This is where you'd expect people to have open minds. And the reality is, I think, over a long period of time, people's minds have been closed like clams, and forcibly so, through media, education. And when your parents have been indoctrinated by the same media and education, they're less capable of raising you to be an independent thinker. And so yeah. You get to the point where you realize that a large majority of people have been trained out of the possibility of having independent thoughts. Originality, and that makes them very easy to control. We'll be right back with hour number two with Jerry and Kathy Wills.